Group meeting, Sunday, 28th July, 1985. This experiencing of the transcendent, the unclouded vision, is shapeless and formless. It is not finite. After the unself-conscious experiencing in which the total mind was wholly silent, the surface mind again sets up the self-conscious experiencer. See, that means one comes back to ordinary brain and sense functioning. So that is the surface mind at work. In Buddhism we've called it vijnana. That is the meaning. In the Upanishadic writings and the Vedic writings, it is vijnana, V-I-J-N-A-N-A, which was presented as vijnana in Pali. See, Pali is slightly cognified Sanskrit. And the mind is wholly silent in the actual supreme state. There are no shapes, there are no forms, because its context is the infinite, the eternal. There cannot be shape and form in that context. Shape and form imply limitation. And limitation starts with the whole process of manifestation. It is an unmanifest state, if you like. The verbalizing faculty intrudes upon the beatitude of silence. Finite images of the imageless infinite materialize the unclouded vision, and thus the word of scripture comes into being. The act of conceiving and the act of verbalizing must be as pure as possible. What sullies the purity is our conditioning, the conditioning of the psychophysical organism through natural evolution for over 1,000 millennia, and the cultural conditioning by the particular society in which we are born and bred and educated. The great teachers were those who, to the highest degree possible in their circumstances, had grown free of their conditioning. I had just read this sentence. The great teachers were those who, to the highest degree possible in their circumstances, had grown free of their conditioning. Now this is a point which we must understand very tolerantly. You notice I say those who to the highest degree possible in their circumstances had grown free of their conditioning. No one in the world, no human being in the world, can ever be totally free of all conditioning. Whether he be the perfected Holy One, or just myself, or any ordinary person like me. You see, it's impossible to be totally free. For this simple reason, each one of us, as a psychophysical organism, is what each one of us is by virtue of an immense evolutionary process. at least about 600 million years. And the qualities which characterize the very early stages are actually in us. It's in our brain. Our brain inherits the whole of our evolutionary process, from the reptilian through the mammalian through the stage of the primates and finally the development of the cortex and so on with man himself. So now this inheritance, which has a troublesome part, the reptilian mammalian part as such, serves as an apparatus for receiving impressions and impulses which are not exactly perfect and holy. So they have, you know how the Buddha's speaking to Ananda, I think, says that he is constantly mindful. But he doesn't say why he has to be constantly mindful. He has to be constantly mindful because, and he did not know this in his day, there is this apparatus here locked in our heads, you see, which serves as a means of receiving evil impressions. So you have to be constantly awake. Now, no one can be constant, no one therefore can be totally free of all conditioning. As and when the human race has progressed sufficiently far and sufficiently satisfactorily so that the new sort of the perfect human creature comes into being, and nature will have to do that, the organism, the perfect organism does come into being, then there won't be this trouble. But no one can ever be completely free of his conditioning. Therefore, there is always a flaw, a difficulty, an obstruction in the way. I think this is one of the reasons why the founders of the great religions and many other very great spiritual teachers have made mistakes, outright mistakes. It was impossible to avoid them. That is the point. You see, you take the example, for instance, of the Buddha's explanation of earthquakes. Then again, he gives a pretty long account in one of the long discourses of how mankind came into existence and so forth and became what he is. Now, you see, we can wipe all that out nowadays. That explanation, that teaching won't hold anymore. So, that's why I use the word tolerant. We have to be extremely tolerant about the errors that have been made by even the greatest of the teachers. A Christ, a Buddha, a Zarathustra, they have all made certain mistakes like that. But supposing they did not make any mistake, then we ourselves at our present stage would be quite different. Because we also inherit those mistakes in our socio-cultural conditioning. They come through. Our teacher said so and so, and we accepted. He is the child of God, he's the perfected Holy One, and all the rest of it. So we accept the statement. And of course, in our own day and age, we have the wonderful example of the fundamentalists. Not only Christian, but Muslim. And of the two fundamentalists, I think, well, perhaps the excuse for the Muslim is that he came into being several hundred years after Christ. But there we are. So never take anything which is expressed in terms of thought and speech as complete truth. It never is. Now, grown free of their conditioning. This freedom is preeminently marked by the fact that each enlightened one outgrew the tradition in which he was brought up and the disciplines in which he was trained. Without seeking to deliberately oust or destroy the faith and religious practice of his own fellow men. You know how Jesus said, "I come not to destroy, but to fulfill." Now that is the sort of proper outlook of those who were holy men. His teaching, nevertheless, inevitably shakes, even cracks a fossilized old order. You find that happening throughout history, right from the beginning, starting with Zarathustra, if you like, to confine ourselves to the Indo-European peoples, and right up to Christ and Muhammad. They introduce a new order, and they introduce quite a new understanding in metaphysical terms as well as psychological terms. This is very important because the psyche of the perfected Holy One is the pure psyche. There is no trace of unvirtuousness there as such. But in the case of Muhammad, he did not introduce that which the previous teachers did introduce. He introduced a great change socially. He was perhaps the greatest social reformer amongst the founders of the religions. You have to study that rather carefully to see what a remarkable change he made with the people of Arabia. The teacher's teaching, nevertheless, but for his true listeners, the word which he utters is the bread of life, for he who has rightly outgrown his conditioning is a creator. His word is the affirmation of the living experiencing of the transcendent. The affirmation which was possible for him during his age and amongst his people and in the line with the particular cultural development that prevailed at that time. All this must be borne in mind. And we can see, therefore, that the outlook of the blind devotee is rather is an outlook which acts as a hindrance on the whole in several respects. His word is, yes, such speech is prophecy, prophetic speech. And the meaning of prophetic speech is just this. It inspires, it moves a person to action, it fecundates the psyche of any person. But it cannot communicate, meaning that it cannot hand over the heart of religion to the listener. He can inspire the listener to realize the heart of religion for any period in history. That has to be done by oneself wheresoever one is living. Because the heart of religion as such is actually produces a complete transformation of consciousness, which remains nondescript. There are no thoughts or words to express that transformation of consciousness. When consciousness is transformed, this mysterious, transcendent, unknown and unknowable energy so affects the psychophysical organism that by virtue of the psyche having been purified, the brain will be able, when it operates through its sense perceptions and so forth, to bring forth a presentation in thought and speech which is quite unusual. That is what happens. At least I think so. Each man has to realize the transcendent for himself, even as the newborn babe has to breathe for himself in order to live as an individual. You know, this is a point which people have never sufficiently appreciated. You know, the moment the fetus emerges out of the womb and starts its life, it lives. Can anybody teach it to live? We can explain and say, oh, because he breathes and this, that and the other functions, therefore he lives. But you know, that is only an explanation of the mechanism. This fact that it lives is a mystery. Now, meditation actually is of that nature. You meditate. No one can teach you how to meditate. Meditation is a functioning in the supreme state of consciousness that you can reach. That is meditation. And that is special, unique, particular to you. It can't be taught. You can't teach the baby how to live. You can give it food, you can give it air, you can give it rest, you can do all that is necessary for the continuance of the living of that babe. But you can't teach it to live. It lives. That's that. It's a mystery. At least it is a mystery to me. Such realization is possible if the quickening light of spiritual insight plays upon the word, for thus there is revelation of living truth. The teacher gives the word, if you like. Yes, but it is your spiritual insight that has to interact, livingly interact with that word. And then the truth reveals itself to you. And when that truth reveals itself to you, you can never put it into a system of thought and speech. You can't systematize it. This living truth, religious truth, is not a doctrine or belief or mental cognition or intuitive perception or verbal statement. It is the unself-conscious, immediate awareness of the actuality of the here-now. It is the actual state of fully awake being, without separatively perceiving being as self and the environment as not-self, without interpreting the infinite reality as an idea, shape, form, sound, touch, smell, or feeling. Let reality be. Let there be no disturbance of the silence, of the peace of God which passes understanding. Just live that life eternal. As and when you enter that state, just let it be. Don't do anything with it. Otherwise you spoil it. Because who will attempt to deal with that? That the Supreme is that which cannot be dealt with by me or anybody else. But it deals with us. And it deals with us by making that extraordinary impress upon the whole organism, which enables the organism to bring forth inspiring insights and so forth. Just live that life eternal. That is the experiencing. That is the substance of religious truth. It is totally lived by whole being. Springing out of that timeless ineffable into time and therefore into experience and event, the mind, if holy, will give expression to prophetic speech. The holiness of the mind depends on spiritual insight, and insight depends on purity of mind and heart. They are mutually interdependable. You know, there's a very remarkable, amongst the hundreds of remarkable things in the Rig Veda. They say, Daksha was born of Aditi, and Aditi was born of Daksha. And this goes on and on perpetually, generating and regenerating each other. As a matter of fact, I'll be talking about this at the summer school in some detail. Religious understanding is not superficial verbal understanding, not simply a sensibilité. It is a knowing by at-one-ment, by a soul union. You become that which you know. You know, 23 centuries ago, Plato said that. He put it slightly, he put the half of it. He said, if you really know, you do it. But you really know only by being it in mind and consciousness. If consciousness hasn't become that which was an object, previously an object of consciousness, then you don't really know it. It is an at-one-ment, as I've written here. The perfection of the subsequent verbalization depends first upon the purity of the mind, and this purity is none other than the freedom from all the conditioning by natural evolution and by socio-cultural influences, and next upon the training and skill of the intellect. If then there is, you see, this chapter is headed the approach to the theme, and the generality of people who are interested approach it purely intellectually. They study the books, you see, and so forth. But that's not enough. If then there is scholarship as well as religious understanding, the theme of this book can be approached seriously and fearlessly. The heart of religion is not a matter for critical analysis or engaging exposition. It has to be lived with our total being. Reader and writer together embark upon a genuine inquiry, a wholehearted, honest experimenting, a ceaseless searching. You see, the ordinary type of inquiring is that one asks a question and awaits an answer. The question is asked out of a mind which is at least a little bit confused, is ignorant, and so forth. And there is the assumption that the teacher will be able to get rid of that confusion totally. Well, that is not the case. Because when the teacher speaks, the real content in his mind is not totally conveyed by his words. One doesn't know the total content of that mind as embodied in what words he uses. See, thought and speech both have considerable limitations. There is no end to this searching, no final answer, for all ends are dead ends. All man-declared finalities are denials of the non-finite. You see, this is one of the tragic mistakes that has been made throughout the millennia. This is the truth, the whole truth, and everything else is, which is not here, spoken or written, is false. There is no such thing as finality possible. Because the manifested cosmos is inevitably and invariably limited. It is changing, it is evolving, it is growing, you see. So no statement about it can be a final statement or about anything in it. We may be on the way to something deeper, something nearer the reality, but that is all. And we have to learn to be great enough, deep enough, capable enough to abide by that fact. It isn't easy. We want the final thing, once and for all. You see, it is this passion for security. Once I know the real thing, then I'll be all right. My dear fellow, if you did happen to come across the real thing to that extent, it will kill you. Because you haven't got that kind of constitution psychophysically to stand that voltage of truth. And consider how even in little ways people cannot be told the whole thing. There is a true story. A workman was working on the roof and a friend of his came along and told him that the lottery ticket which he had bought had won the first prize, you see. So excited him, he rolled off the roof and was killed when he fell down. Our inquiring and experimenting and searching is simply, I should have said, has to be, our love gift to life abundant. Through motiveless outpouring of this gift, there is measureless discovery of the unknown. You see, if a gift is a true love gift, one doesn't think in terms of what am I going to get back. I've given him this present, what is he going to give to me on my birthday? None of that. It has to be a pure love gift, unconditional, unreserved, expecting nothing, hoping for nothing, wanting nothing, demanding nothing. Now, if our search, if our seeking the transcendence itself, which in any case the whole cosmic process is moving towards, you see, if that is the case, then it has to be an absolutely pure love gift. Being serious means, therefore, that neither reader nor writer may embark on this voyage with any ulterior motive. A defined motive is no other than a fixation by the mortal in terms of the limited and the particular. Thus we merely tread the wretched round of mortality and miserably fulfill the mortal motive predestined, an illusion whose sad fate is death. How can ever dying mortality compass or reveal ever living immortality? Many a high-sounding motive may lure the unwary writer to expound the true meaning of Holy Scripture, to comfort the sorrowing, to enlighten those in darkness, to serve God, etc., etc. Can we not see that they are all rooted in selfness, delusion, pride, conceit? I had the conceit to call this the heart of religion. There's an actual example. Ignorance, hate, power lust, and greed, that they are all modes of exploitation of man by man. And yet, if a writer writes because carefree, thoughtless love carries him on the crest of a creative life wave, might not all pure motives find sweet and unpremeditated fulfillment? You see, the difficulty with a motive, it may be as high sounding, I only want to serve God, give my life for God and all the rest of that stuff, you see. Even a high sounding motive has the element of selfness in it. Analyze it carefully. I do this. You find it especially between married couples and friends who are very fond of each other and so on. My dear, I'm doing all this for your sake and so forth. Am I? If it is done for your sake, well, it is done for your sake. But I am not doing it. Because the I consciousness is everlastingly a limiter, something which cuts short. So let every calculated motive be eschewed, and let reader and writer approach the heart of religion as beggars, stripped, dispossessed. Our greatest qualification when we approach the unknown is that we know nothing. We mustn't have the presumption that we know something about it. We don't. Transcendence is so transcendent that the psychophysical organism and the IMI consciousness which associates itself with that organism has to realize that it knows nothing at all, really. The mind is empty. The attention is blind, waiting to be shown. Deaf, waiting the word. Bisexed and unprocreative, waiting the immaculate conception and virgin birth. Lame, waiting the leading of the divine hand. In this clean state of primordial newness, we may beg for our daily bread in all seriousness. I wonder how many people out of the hundreds of millions who repeat the Lord's Prayer daily understand this. Begging for our daily bread. They say, oh no, of course it's not physical bread, it's our spiritual bread. But what on earth are you talking about for our spiritual bread? My spiritual bread. And that my is the one thing that de-spiritualizes it instantaneously. The mind is empty. The attention glows white hot. This emptiness does not mean the blankness of total ignorance. We do still have our knowledge through the experience of our whole past in the form of technical skills, intellectual perceptions, aesthetic faculties, and any other forms that make up our psychological content. But whereas in the past we felt we possessed knowledge, when in actual fact we were possessed and imprisoned by beliefs and ideas, and in short our total experience. Whereas in the past we were in the unenlightened state, the state of avidya, as taught in India, we have now the felicity of completely dying to the past and to every flickering mortal moment. The whole process, the living process of growing towards enlightenment, is a process of continuously and completely dying to the actual manifested present. If we know how to die to the actual manifested present, then we emerge into a profounder state, which marks real spiritual development. You see, the whole human race up to date is so accustomed to think of development as gaining some quality, some skill, some knowledge, some this, that and the other. There is no question at all of gaining, and therefore also no question at all of losing. Where am I? So, the attentiveness, if we can die to the known present continuously, the attentiveness lives immortally. Your attentiveness, therefore, undergoes a series of infinite births and deaths from moment to moment. It lives immortally at white heat, unbound by the psychological movement of sense impressions, perceptions, conceptions, or ideas through the whole of chronological time. This is the enlightened state, the state of vidya, the state of creative emptiness, of the void. It is in this silent state that oneself is the instrument for the ceaseless creative activity of the source of everything, the primordial creative energy. We think we create as psychophysical beings. We only procreate. Biologically, that everybody knows. But everybody doesn't realize that what we call the creations of the great artists, engineers, philosophers, and so on, scientists and so on, that is cultural procreation. It is true to type. It has had a past, as we call it, and it will have a future if there is development. Now, whatsoever has a past as an origin, instead of origin itself, the transcendent origin, you see, if it has a past as an origin, and if it sort of looks forward to a future, that is the way of procreation. We have had, the human species has had an immense past, at least about 3.5 million years since the first chappie walked on two legs, and so forth. Now, he has developed and developed and become what we are like today. And we think in terms of a development for a future. Now, all this is a procreative process. The creative process is utterly new. It has no past, it has no future. There is only the absolute now, the eternal now. The intellect can see it this way. But what the intellect sees in any way, if it sees truly, then your consciousness undergoes that transformation which enables you to be conscious in that way. And then all your thought and feeling, speech and action will represent in a passing, ephemeral form, something which dies, great stream of life itself, you see, creative activity of consciousness. This is the enlightenment, the state of creative emptiness, of the void which is filled with the perpetual flashing of the plenum. This is the state of freedom. This is the open mind, that is to say, imperfection. The mind that is unbiased and unprejudiced, the mind whose light is never darkened by any preconception or assumption. With this mind, this is the serious mind, one can fearlessly approach the heart of religion. We can now be true scholars, that is, true disciples, which means true learners. The true learner is a ceaseless discoverer of the new, not just a modifier, however brilliant, of the past. I should have said the true learner is a ceaseless discoverer of the relatively new. Because I, as a discoverer, can only discover something which is a little bit ahead of what it is now, and then there is always further progress, further development. Unto him, the infinite unknown continuously moves into a temporal beatitude of the known. Now one really begins to know something. To know in the sense in which the great teachers and the greatest of the philosophers talked about knowing and what knowing implied. He, the bereaved beggar, holds out a bottomless bowl, an invisible fiery ring of adoration, through which the endless stream of divine beneficence flows. He is aflame with enlightenment. To him, in love with truth, transcendent wisdom is an open book, and his blind attentiveness fills the world with streaming light. He doesn't know about it. The world doesn't perceive it usually, but it benefits. The earth doesn't know that the sun streams out light and heat to the earth. But the thing happens. You see, this is the sort of thing which is faith. The thing happens. This is faith in its, as far as I can see, in its transcendent sense. He, true scholar, neither clings to ideas or beliefs or doctrines, nor does he impose them on any man. Free of selfness, with its endless conflict of grasping vainly for self-perpetuation against the implacable destruction regeneration wrought by the death, rebirth of the becoming process. He is free of fear. Let reader and writer, thus prepared, study the religions of the past and study religion which is now present, never forgetting that for the study of religion, the spirit demands a renunciation by intellect which is not required by any worldly study.